Today is Friday, March 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The coronavirus forces more cancellations.
Sporting events are canceled. Amusement parks like Disneyland and Disney World are closing. Broadway shows are canceled. Some colleges have started canceling and cutting back on graduation.
Plus, the U.S. carries out airstrikes against those it believes are responsible for killing three service members.
But let me be clear. The United States will not tolerate attacks against our people, our interests, or our allies.
And a look at Nigerian music. Those stories and more next. More than 128,000 cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus have been detected in China's Wuhan city, which is ground zero of the new coronavirus outbreak. They reported only 5 cases Friday, the second day in a row that the tally has been less than 10. The remainder of China reported no locally transmitted infections. In South Korea, 110 new coronavirus cases were reported, continuing its downward trend in new cases. In the United States, congressional Democrats are at odds with the Trump administration over legislation that could provide a swift response to the catastrophic public health and economic impact of the coronavirus. The battle between the White House and Capitol Hill comes as many Democrats say Trump's Wednesday night Oval Office speech was inadequate in addressing the growing U.S. crises. In addition, at least one U.S. governor is urging people to watch out for their elderly relatives and neighbors who are heeding the advice to stay away from crowded places. The AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Global health experts have determined the new coronavirus is especially dangerous for older people and the infirm, starting around age 50 and getting incrementally higher. So Georgia Governor Brian Kemp says it's important to make sure the elderly have food and medicine so they don't have to go out.
I've already had this conversation with my mother to keep her safe and plan how we can get her what she needs in the weeks ahead.
In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo says no visitors at nursing homes.
If you care about someone in a nursing home, the last thing you want is to endanger that person.
One elderly advocate says it's important to phone older friends and relatives because they're probably feeling more isolated now with limited trips and interactions. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who met with U.S. President Donald Trump last weekend, in a Fox News report, has tested positive for the coronavirus. The White House will hold an urgent meeting on Bolsonaro's positive test later on Friday, but has not yet released any details on Mr. Trump's status. Elsewhere, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's wife has tested positive for the coronavirus. Trudeau is quarantining himself at home after his wife exhibited flu-like symptoms. Trudeau's office said that the prime minister is in good health with no symptoms. Spain has ordered its first mandatory lockdown, confining over 60,000 people to 4 towns as infections for the coronavirus increased sharply. As more and more sports events, schools, and even Disneyland in California close out of concern about the spread of COVID-19, there is a palpable rise in the tension and anxiety over these events. To learn more about the precautions being implemented and how to address these concerns, I spoke with Dr. Runjan Mishra, an internal medicine doctor.
Let me explain to you why these closures are happening. These closures are happening because we need to enforce social distancing. I'll explain what that means. Social distancing means keeping a distance of, 6 feet or more from a person. Now, that's a recommendation CDC is giving. Implementing this social distancing and shutting down events and shutting down places where there could be potential large gatherings, this is the only way to stop and slow down the spread, because when people don't find each other amidst large groups, they don't have the ability to spread the virus. And when they don't have the ability to spread the virus, then we can slow down the curve of how many people are getting infected every day, because it's not something that's maybe going to happen. It's happening. We're in the middle of this. Your next question is, with all these other things happening right now, how does that make the public feel? Well, of course, it instills a lot of panic and fear, because this has never really been done recently, and those feelings are completely normal. However, this is not the time to be fearful. This is not the time to panic. We need to be a little bit more proactive with our feelings. And I know it's all, you know, feelings at the end of the day are all electrical impulses that our brain sends out. So how do we control them? Well, we take action. And if we take action and convert that fear and panic into something practical and something useful that we can do, that's what's going to, you know, help us and save us from having this coronavirus pandemic turn into something maybe we can control versus something that's going to take over our lives. And that's what's important to remember.
If we take a look at the numbers that are coming out from the WHO, from the CDC, from other health organizations, you know, the sheer number of cases continues to grow as the coronavirus spreads across the world. When you look at the numbers of the rise in cases, the number of deaths that are continuously being reported, how can people around the globe interpret those into a way that doesn't contribute to a sense of panic?
So I think that stems from understanding how coronavirus, for example, is different from other illnesses that we're very used to every year. People are used to the cold, people are used to the flu. And when we talk about cold and flu season, no one panics because now that's become part of our routine life every year. However, just looking at the flu, that contributes to so many deaths every single year. And I guess because now we're used to it, we don't really bat an eye. However, coronavirus is found to be 10 times, at least 10 times more lethal than the flu. And what that means is that the flu has a lethality of 0.1%. And what we're predicting is coronavirus will likely have a lethality of 1%. Current figures show that maybe the lethality right now is about 2 to 3.4%, but that's really because we're not testing people aggressively enough.
What makes the COVID-19 so much more readily or so much more deadly than the flu?
That's a good question. So a couple of clarifications. One, this coronavirus is new, number one, but coronaviruses have been present for many, many years. And a lot of the other coronaviruses are what cause the common cold. But this is very new. And what it's doing, which is different from the flu, is the flu usually, you know, one person infects one person. Coronavirus, one person. What we're seeing is one person affects 2 to 3 people. So that exponential exposure that coronavirus is causing is what's causing the increase in numbers and the trends. It's just more transmissible. That's what we're finding.
Runjun Mishra is a doctor of internal medicine. The travel industry has been hit especially hard during the coronavirus outbreak, and it remains unclear what the recent effect the travel restrictions the United States and other nations have enacted to contain its spread will have on that airline industry. Now, to break down that part of the story, I spoke with Perry Flint, communications manager with the International Air Transport Association, about its impact.
It's simply been a dramatically negative impact. It's difficult for those who have not been following the industry for a long time to understand how deeply these actions and the underlying COVID-19 virus are affecting the industry, but maybe some numbers will help. Before the latest actions by the U.S. government with regard to travelers from Europe, IATA had estimated that in a bad case, this was just a week before, in a bad case, the industry could lose about $113 billion of revenue this year compared to last year. So that's about a 19% drop. Now, that was before the latest measures that have been announced by the U.S. government. That's an enormous number. And that $113 billion loss in passenger revenue basically takes us back to the kind of levels we experienced during the global financial crisis. So simply catastrophic. Now, if we look at the latest actions, the market between the United States and the Schengen area of Europe is an absolutely vital market for the airline industry, for U.S. and European airlines. Last year, there were about 46 million passengers who traveled in that market. That works out to about 125,000 a day. In terms of value, it's about a $21 billion market. So these latest actions will simply have a very, very dramatic effect on airline cash flow, on airline revenue. Planes are load factors are way below break even. It's just an extraordinarily difficult time for this industry.
You mentioned that load factors are well below break even, given the financial difficulties in this time. How are airlines going to be able to pull through, and how long can they continue under these circumstances?
Well, we haven't tried to calculate, you know, how long this can go on, and it's a broad and diverse industry. I would point out that that we already had one well-publicized failure, an airline based in the UK named Flybe, and they shut down just within the last 10 days, I believe. Citing the impact of what was going on with COVID 19, I think that basically, if we look at it, it's not a matter of large airline or small airline. It's an issue of how well capitalized an airline is. What is its cash position? How long can it go when it's not really selling many tickets? What we have said is that the industry is going to need some support and from governments. Governments are taking actions that are having a dramatic impact on the industry's ability to operate. And therefore, it seems that it's reasonable to hope that governments will also take some actions to mitigate the position of the airline industry. And we've suggested things such as lightening the tax burden, reducing infrastructure costs, so that's airport and air navigation services, lines of credit, those sorts of things.
That was communications manager with the International Air Transport Association, Perry Flint. Top Japanese government officials on Friday said they were determined to hold safe and secure Olympics on schedule, a day after U.S. President Donald Trump said Tokyo should consider delaying them for a year because of the pandemic. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that part of the story.
Japan's Olympics minister was quick to hit back at U.S. President Donald Trump Friday, saying the Olympics are on schedule and, quote, safe and secure.
We are not thinking of reducing spectators at all. I understand the IOC and Tokyo 2020 will make an effort to hold the Games as planned, in coordination with the Tokyo government.
The remarks were made hours after Trump suggested Tokyo should delay the Games for a year amid the coronavirus outbreak.
Just can't see having no people there. In other words, not allowing people. You know, I like that better than I like having empty stadiums all over the place. I think if you cancel it, make it a year later, that's a better alternative than doing it with no crowd.
Officials say Japanese leader Shinzo Abe later spoke with Trump on the phone for about 50 minutes Friday morning Japan time. Trump then tweeted a more upbeat message, calling the just-completed Olympic venue magnificent and saying Abe had done an incredible job and good things will happen for Japan and their great Prime Minister. Friday's comments fit with Japan's efforts to quash speculation that the Games may not go ahead. This year's Olympics have cost the country at least $12 billion in preparations and attracted more than $3 billion in domestic sponsorships.
That was Libby Hogan from Reuters News. The Tokyo Metropolitan Government did, however, say it would postpone the opening ceremony of the Olympic Aquatic Center due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now, as stock exchanges continue to grapple with the economic impact of the coronavirus, I spoke to senior non-resident fellow David Wilcox at the Peterson Institute for International Economics about the current bear markets worldwide and how the economy may be affected by the current global expansion of the coronavirus.
Well, like everybody else, market participants are trying to figure out what direction this very unusual situation is going. And, you know, none of us has any experience within our lifetime of social distancing, the widespread closures and dysfunction that that's going to bring. So there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty and no track record to go on in terms of predicting what the ramifications of the situation are going to be.
Now, if we take a look, you mentioned social distancing. We're already seeing huge economic impacts with people being asked to stay indoors, runs on commodities, toilet paper, other things that people are having, rate cuts by central banks. You know, if we take a look at the global economy, as the coronavirus extends its reach across the globe, what kind of things do you expect to see on a global scale with respect to the economy?
Well, one thing that's going to be just extraordinary, I think certainly unprecedented during my career in economics, is we're going to witness a coordinated, synchronized shock to the global economy, where every country across the globe is going to be adversely affected all at once. And that has very dangerous implications, because what it will mean is that there's going to be no country in the world that will be able to function as a locomotive for the rest of the global economy. And that really, in my experience, has no precedent.
Now, if we take a look at the health of the economy, there have been discussions about whether or not the world is headed towards a recession, given the bear markets, given the rate cuts. Are we there yet?
Yeah, I think we are. One thing that's going to be really remarkable about this situation is that different people are going to experience this situation in remarkably different ways.
What's the economic risk to countries without robust health care systems?
So I'm an economist, and yes, I'll get to the economic question in just a minute, but let's start with the more important dimension, which is the human side of it. Even for countries that have advanced health systems, the human toll here is going to be enormous. So one of the key priorities is to try to slow the curve and stretch out the time period over which infections take place, so that the capacity of the healthcare system, whatever it is preserved as much as possible to serve sick individuals.
David Wilcox is a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And still to come in today's program.
Then next in the head, Igbo, like, oh my gosh, she's Nigerian. So yeah, I think that's like me doing that has sort of like broken that divide that would have said, oh, she's one Oyibo artist, and make them feel like, yes, they have someone in Nigeria doing stuff like that.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A University of Geneva-led study provides evidence that it rains droplets of iron during the evening on the exoplanet WASP-76b. Study authors described the planet as an ultra-hot super Jupiter located 390 light-years away, and that it's tidally locked with its star. This means that the planet has a permanent day and night side. The day side temperature is said to be over 2400 degrees Celsius, hot enough to vaporize metals like iron into the atmosphere. Nightside temperatures drop to 1,500 degrees Celsius. The study authors found that strong winds are generated due to the temperature difference between the two sides of the planet. These winds carry the vaporized iron from the ultra-hot day side to the cooler night side, forming iron droplets that then fall like rain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United States waged a series of precision airstrikes Thursday against an Iran-backed militia in Iraq that it blames for a major rocket attack a day earlier that killed two American troops and a 26-year-old British soldier. To get the details on the operation, I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
So what happened last night is the U.S. retaliated against Kataib Hezbollah. That is the Iranian-backed proxy group inside of Iraq and Syria. They have said now that the KH group has been responsible for the attacks on Camp Taji that killed two American service members and one British medic. They hit targets that look, I'm looking at where the targets were right now, and if I had to describe them to you so you could picture it, they're all within about 100 kilometers of Baghdad. And they showed us pictures of these weapons storage facilities, which General McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, said were chosen so they could further degrade their ability to launch attacks against coalition troops in the future.
Is this the end of the retaliation, or are they looking at carrying out more operations?
He would not go there. In fact, I asked General McKenzie what striking Kataib Hezbollah does to prevent Iran from backing these and trying to carry out attacks that will try to push the United States out of the region. And he didn't want to hint towards any future attacks, but he did say that I'm not going to talk about what we may or may not do in the future.
What else can you tell us about the events taking place in the Middle East?
Well, we know that Iran has had a need to lash out, according to defense officials, but they are doing this militarily because they do not have a diplomatic arm or an economic arm to use. And so they say that is why they're using these proxy groups. There were attacks late last year, and the United States responded in January by striking Qasem Soleimani, and then Iran had struck the U.S. No one was hurt, and they thought that tensions were going down. But General McKenzie is saying that was an illusion. The threat is still very real. The threat is just as high as before Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Iranian Quds Force, the guy who was coordinating between Iran's regime and all of these proxy groups they have around the Middle East. Once he was gone, he said the threat has still remained high. What has changed is Iran's ability to communicate with these proxy forces. So that is one thing that the United States is still trying to decipher. Is Kataib Hezbollah acting under the direct orders of an Iranian general, or are there some people in Kataib Hezbollah going rogue and striking the U.S. and coalition forces? But one thing that has been clear, this was a significant attack. McKenzie said that they had used 33 rockets they were trying to launch. 30 of them actually were launched, and then 3 people were killed. And then outside of this attack, McKenzie said that there's been a dozen attacks in the last 6 months by Kataib Hezbollah. So definitely a ratcheting up of tensions in the region.
Carla Babb reports for VOA from the U.S. Pentagon. Musician Bianca Okoracha, a.k.a. Clay, is carving a niche in Nigerian music scene that's normally dominated by Afrobeats. Reuters' Nneka Chile reports.
In a music scene dominated by Afrobeats, Bianca Okoracha, a.k.a. Clay, is challenging the idea that Nigerians don't rock out. Nigerian rock is such an alien concept to some that when they hear Okoracha, who calls herself the Nigerian rock goddess, they think it's from another country. That is, onto her lyrics flipped from English into local languages.
Then next thing they heard Igbo, like, oh my gosh, she's Nigerian. So yeah, I think that's like me doing that has sort of like broken that divide that would have said, oh, she's one Igbo artist, and make them feel like, yes, they have someone Nigerian and stuff like that.
Okoracha began singing in a church choir before moving on to performing in bars and at concerts. Her influence was her father's love of rock music.
Rock music chose me because even when I was young, without any idea or plan of going into music at all, I was already writing songs inside, and they were all rock songs.
Okoracha says she likes to write about things that have happened to her. Her latest single, Waiting You Want, tells a story of defiance in a city of crooks and hustlers under the catchphrase, This is Lagos.
Sometimes it gets dark, but not dark in a satanist way. Like, I try to touch on people's emotions like depression, sadness, losing someone.
Today, Okoracha collaborates with other alternative artists as they collectively push to grow their genres and find room to thrive in Nigeria's vibrant music scene.
That was Nneka Chile from Reuters. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.